failure of drug war is glaringly obvious to judges, cops, wardens, prosecutors, and millions more now calling for decriminalization, legalization, the end of prohibition. Let us investigate the century of lies. Welcome to this edition of Century of Lies. Today, we'll listen back to last month's exit strategy for the War on Drugs conference, held in Seattle, Washington, sponsored by the King County Bar Association, KCBA.org. The second panel of the conference was moderated by Eric Sterling, president of the Criminal Justice Policy Foundation in Washington, D.C., CJPF.org. This is Eric Sterling.
We have a very intriguing title, What the Current Drug Control System Allows. And in the spirit of paradox that we've framed the conference, when I saw the title, it struck me as paradoxical, because a lot of our conversation will be what the system allows, meaning the harms that it tolerates. And another way, of course, of thinking about it is in the intellectual stretching model that Ethan talked about. What does the system allow for us to do in its context? What are the reforms that the system allows? And so we'll see to what extent the tension between those paradoxical views of the same title might be. So let us begin then in terms of thinking about what the system allows in the sense of what the system has tolerated, what the system has created. And I'd like to ask first then, San Ho Tree, my old friend from the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, Washington's oldest liberal progressive think tank. And San Ho, a fellow there, has brought to the Institute for Policy Studies a very sophisticated and powerful presence in regard to drug policy that had been missing until he came. So please welcome San Ho Tree.
Thank you, Eric. I'm going to start with a short quote from one of my favorite popular philosophers. Last name of Simpson, first name Bartholomew. In the way of framing the current problem, he ran for class president against the nerdy character Martin, and he begins his campaign with a blistering speech, and he says, "Friends, my opponent says there are no easy answers. I say he's not looking hard enough." That, in a nutshell, is what's keeping us locked into this drug war, at the federal level at least. I think that if I had to name three factors that really keep this policy locked in place in Congress, it would be fear, ignorance, and opportunism. You talk to a lot of these members of Congress and their staff off the record, and they'll tell you this system isn't working, will never work, but they're afraid. They're afraid of being swift-voted, smeared during election campaigns. There are some who are ignorant. They really do believe, well, drugs are bad, therefore we have to fight it. And they vote, without really thinking too much about this issue. And then there are the small minority who are the opportunists, who are the ones who will run the negative ads, who have chairmanships of relevant committees and think they can make their career and their name by being tougher on drugs than their predecessors. So these are the three things that keep us in place. However, when our legislators see these kinds of illegal activities and behaviors, whether it's cultivating drugs or trafficking or money laundering or using, you're breaking the law. And their very simple knee-jerk reaction is to escalate law enforcement. You're breaking the law, we're going to make you stop. Well, the problem with doing that is that year after year after year, as we escalate law enforcement, the kinds of people we typically capture are the people who are dumb enough to get caught. No offense if anyone's ever been busted for anything here, but the slang on the street is that the dealer who uses loses. You get careless, you get sloppy, you get apprehended. And by default, the kinds of people we typically miss when we keep escalating law enforcement are the most efficient drug traffickers. Right? So the drug economy evolves under Darwinian principles in many ways. And so for decades now, we've had this unintended consequence of artificial selection. We've been selectively breeding super traffickers. Right, we've been thinning out the herd. Occasionally, you do get the exception; they do, high-level busts and stuff. But as a rule, we thin out the herd, and we can't hope to win a war on drugs when our policies see to it that only the most efficient operations survive. And not only do they survive, but they thrive because we've again done two things unintentionally to help them. Number one, we've artificially tried to constrict the supply of drugs while the demand remains constant, thereby driving up prices and profits. And number two, we've eliminated their competition for them. Right, we picked off the inefficient traffickers. And opened up this incredibly lucrative space for them. And so one of the most simplistic solutions on the part of legislators is they say, well, we know where the stuff is coming from. We know where they grow it. Why don't we just go down there and hit it while it's on the ground before it reaches our streets and poisons our kids? And so I just want to give you a sense of the scale of the problem we're talking about, however. Let me put this in terms of numbers. The peak year of cultivation of coca, 2001, there were 220,000 hectares grown in South America. All right, that's all the coca that's chewed by indigenous people, used for tea, processed into cocaine, all the cocaine that's intercepted and destroyed, all of that. The entire world's demand can be grown on 220,000 hectares. Well, what does that mean to city people? Well, you convert that, it comes out to 849 square miles. So another way of putting this, the entire world's demand for coca, cocaine, and all the stuff that's intercepted can be grown on a square piece of land 29 miles on a side. Now, in South America alone, there are more than 2.5 million square miles suitable for cultivating coca. All right. So when you have all that land plus this inexhaustible reservoir of poor, impoverished farmers who are willing to take those risks to grow this stuff, it's very difficult to stop this. And so the best we've ever been able to do is push it from one country to the next. It's been about as effective as shoveling water through eradication policies. Nonetheless, this is the main instrument of our policy these days in South America. Under Plan Colombia, we spent more than $4 billion in the past 5 years trying to eradicate coca and opium poppy on the ground using crop dusters. We've sprayed more than 1.5 million acres of this country, which is bigger than Texas and California combined. Colombia is a huge country, the second most biodiverse country in the world, so we've caused a lot of environmental damage without having much measurable impact on the streets of the United States in terms of price, purity, availability of cocaine. And this also, by the way, is another unintended consequence. Eradication and interdiction is a form of unintended price support. Right? It's, instead of paying farmers not to grow things, we do it for them involuntarily, and thereby boosting up the prices of these crops. And in areas of the world where there's such an unimaginable poverty, in Colombia alone, more than two-thirds of the population lives below about $2.50 a day. Imagine surviving on that kind of income. You will never make these crops disappear by making them more valuable, which is exactly what our policies are doing. And nonetheless, we keep spraying. And these are places that I've been. I took this during rainy season in Putumayo, Colombia, southern Colombia, which is the epicenter of U.S. drug policy focus. And this is a field where there's no coca at all. We sprayed that. It should be lush and green. Everything's brown and devastated. So we miss a lot of times. And these are many, many fields I've been to like this. But also farmers get sprayed. This woman I've been following for 4 years now. She and her husband did exactly as we asked. She tore up their coca crops, planted alternative development crops. We have since sprayed her farm 4 times, accidentally, according to the U.S. Embassy, all by accident, 4 times, 3 times directly and 1 time through aerial drift. They're trying to spray at a neighboring farm. And there are countless farmers who are in this similar situation. There's also a lot of human health effects as well as environmental effects, a lot of rashes, diarrhea, vomiting, infant death associated with our spray planes. These planes come without warning, and people are caught in the fields, and they get sprayed. And the final image I want to show you is that these are something you never hear about in the discourse in Washington, right? Except to say that these are the future narco-terrorists of Colombia. These are kids, children of campesinos, peasant farmers who will do whatever it takes to feed their kids. And they're holding up some of the legitimate food crops that we've destroyed. And it's this generation, ultimately, that has to cooperate if our current drug strategy is ever to succeed. They have to agree to stop growing these illicit crops, and they have to agree not to join the illegal armed actors, the guerrillas and the right-wing paramilitary death squads that are plaguing this country. And instead of bringing these people into the fold of the state to show them that we offer you a better way out, we punish them without offering anything in return. And so we are alienating them from the state, thereby guaranteeing future generations of so-called narco-terrorists. I can deconstruct that term later if you like. But again, unintended consequences. And finally, we've declared a war on drugs. I'm a former military historian, and I'll tell you, I've learned that wars are about employing brute force to extract a political concession, a capitulation from a rational state actor. Unfortunately, we're applying this paradigm against plants. The coca seed is not going to sit in the ground and think to itself, well, should I stay dormant for 6 more months while I fetch a better price in the market then? Or what's the latest threat coming from the U.S. Congress? Plants are not rational actors. They don't obey the laws of Congress. They obey the laws of nature and the laws of the market. However, because our policies of prohibition give these plants so much value, millions of individuals around the world have attached themselves to the drug economy, either out of poverty or addiction or to fund an insurgency, for whatever reason, or greed, they enter the drug economy because they think they'll get away with it, and most of them do. And so when you talk about all these individual actors, whether it's the coca farmer in Colombia, the poppy farmer in Afghanistan, the kid in the high school bathroom dealing marijuana or whatever, you will never get an organized surrender, a coherent capitulation from all these individual actors, right? For decades, we've declared war against an enemy who is quite literally incapable of surrendering. So this is, by definition, a forever war. It's a quagmire. And when I talk to my contacts in the Pentagon, for instance, Korean military folks, they'll tell you, candidly, that there are two tours of duty you never want to pull in the military if you're career military, because they're considered career killers. The first one is peacekeeping, and the second one is counter-narcotics. Because they're not traditional military functions. There's no victory to be had. No one surrenders at the end of this. And if you do your job perfectly, no one notices anything. Right? You have safe streets. No one's on drugs. There's no car bombs going off. But the moment you mess up, the moment you fail, then it's like that bar Cheers, right? Everyone knows your name. And the military learned its lesson in Vietnam. Don't stick our butts out there in a line of fire without telling us exactly what it is we need to do before we can declare victory and come home and get our medals and parades and promotions and get on with our careers. And so when we bring this back to the local level, domestic law enforcement, they have the worst of both worlds. First, you've got to maintain the peace while at the same time enforcing prohibition. And this audience, I think, knows very well that the two, in many ways, are mutually exclusive. So for those people out there who still believe in the war on drugs and are supporters, I think we have to say to them, look, there's nothing patriotic, there's nothing sensible about sending our troops and our domestic law enforcement on a fool's errand. And that there is no shame in admitting a mistake, right? The only shame comes from those who, in the face of overwhelming contradictory evidence, refuses to admit the failures of these mistakes and forces other people to suffer those consequences of those mistakes. So thank you very much.
You're listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network. We're tuning in to last month's Exit Strategy for the War on Drugs conference in Seattle, Washington. The speaker you just heard was Sanho Tri of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C. Next up, you'll once again hear the moderator of this panel, Mr. Eric Sterling.
Sanho, thank you very, very much. You know, when you describe the economics, the consequences of our enforcement policy, that it doesn't make sense that we're trying to drive up the price. Yet, of course, that is the explicit goal that the head of DEA tells the Congress that the government is trying to accomplish. And it is, expressed in their regular measurements of the price and purity data that they report to the Congress. So that their best benchmark of their effectiveness in the marketplace is an utterly illogical objective, that the entire premise of what they're doing is intellectually absurd. I think that's important as we talk about the politics of this issue to help people understand that what drug enforcement is trying to do is intellectually impossible, it's economically impossible. And I'm also very happy that Sanho raised the issue that is similar to the issue that Cliff Thornton raised in the commentary in the last session, which is the economic impact of reform, that there are those who benefit economically. We don't think of them as powerful vested interests. We don't think of campesinos as economically powerful vested interests. But there is a livelihood that exists because of prohibition. And it's important for us as we work through the details of replacing prohibition to think about what the economic consequences will be for such folks. I'd like to introduce now Graham Boyd. Graham is one of the one of the most brilliant litigators of his generation. He is a terrific legal strategist. Graham Boyd.
This is an interesting gathering and in some ways a challenging panel within this gathering, because we were set the task this morning of not critiquing the drug war because everybody is already on board with there are all these problems. We're going to try to look towards an exit strategy. And yet I think that's largely what the four of us are going to be doing, is critiquing the drug war. So I'm trying to think about how to talk about the subject I'm going to address, which is about human rights and the Bill of Rights, in a way that sort of does fit that agenda. And so I guess what I want to ask you to do is to hear what I'm going to say with this in mind. We're going to think about alternatives to the current system, and some of those suggestions will be about incremental changes. Some of the suggestions will be about paradigmatic, almost reversals of what we're doing. But especially as we think about those incremental changes, I want you to think about how will that affect the values of democracy and of human rights that I think are central to what we're doing. I think a little bit about how the support for the war in Iraq and the war on terror is waning, and I think a lot of that is because people are saying we've given away too much with the Patriot Act. We've given away too much with all the power that's been ceded to the executive branch. We're compromising what the country is fundamentally about in order to attain goals of fighting terrorism or whatever the goals are that one thinks of that. And I think a lot of that is true of the war on drugs, too. Just even accepting the premises that we want to address the harms of drugs themselves and the harms of drug policy. I want to talk a little bit about how it is that a regime of criminalization has an impact on the Constitution itself. And not on sort of at the individual level, but really at a big structural level. So I'm going to do that by way of example. I think that there's not really time here to do it in the encyclopedia fashion, but just a few examples. One of them, freedom of religion. Now, freedom of religion really, one would think, should have not that much to do with drug policy. Yet, here's the deal. The rules that pertain to freedom of religion were set by the Supreme Court over approximately 100 years. And there developed a test for any government action which discriminated on the basis of religion, which was very protective of free practice of religion. And that was Supreme Court precedent until there came to the court a case involving drugs, a case called Employment Division versus Smith, which had to do with Native Americans in Oregon using peyote. Now, in that case, the Supreme Court kind of had to deal with two competing interests here. One was, are we going to really allow people to use drugs and have that trump other laws? We're not. And with that decision, the Supreme Court reversed decades of longstanding practice and said, no, the test for religious discrimination is no longer what we used to think it is. But now what we're going to say is that a law of general application, for instance, the drug laws, that happen to have an impact on someone's religious practice are okay. So the drug laws trump religious freedom. Now that led, really in some ways I think surprisingly, to quite a reaction. Congress passed unanimously, which Congress doesn't often do, a law that was intended to essentially overrule the Supreme Court and say, no, religious freedom is more important. The Religious Freedom Restoration Act was passed by Congress. And the Supreme Court then got involved again in a case called Birney and came along and said that this case involving a Catholic church in Texas, that where the zoning laws of general application, meant that this church couldn't build in the way that it planned to do, that the church couldn't go forward, and the Supreme Court said we meant what we said, so they struck down the federal law, said that religious freedom would suffer, and so suddenly this thing that had sort of started as a drug war issue had grown into something that literally had nothing to do with drugs, and yet had changed the fundamental rules of how this important concept of religious freedom operates. Something had grown to be much broader than that. And I think that is as good an example as any, and there are many that one could point to, of how a system of laws that basically says we, the government, are going to get involved in deciding what individuals can do in terms of taking drugs, what they put into their bodies. If the government is going to claim that role for itself, then to enforce those laws is going to involve all kinds of claims of governmental power that really shift the way that things work. And the religious freedom, you know, the latest chapter to be written in that is actually a case that's under submission in the Supreme Court right now involving a religious practice by a group called UDV that uses a not widely used psychoactive substance in its religious ceremonies. And you know, maybe the tide will shift back in the other direction. But it's just it's interesting that with freedom of religion, something that should seem so far removed, the drug war ends up encroaching. Free speech is another area, and I think this is more intuitively obvious. The government spends a tremendous amount of money running these ads which are largely propaganda. Some of them, I think, really are legitimate public health messages about drugs, but most of them, certainly many of the ads, are much more about ideology, are about trying to convince people that the war on drugs is justified, that drugs are a bad thing, that, you know, when you smoke marijuana, you're funding the terrorists, things that are often untrue, are almost always exaggerated, and are very much attuned to a political agenda. Now, under the First Amendment, the government can do that. It can speak its own mind. But what the government can't do is interfere with other people who want to disagree with that message. And that's, again, foundational to this country, to the Bill of Rights, to everything that has been true of the United States since the very founding, is that idea of free and open discussion. And yet, with the war on drugs, the exceptions are there. What Thurgood Marshall bemoaned in a dissent in a Supreme Court case as the drug war exception to the Bill of Rights. Well, with free speech, Congress passed a law, for instance, and again, I'm not going to give the whole list, but just a couple of examples. Congress passed a law saying that public transit ads that dealt with the issue of drugs could only favor the government's position. If you have a bus ad or a subway ad or any kind of ad that's on a public transit system, if the ad said drugs are bad, current drug policies are good, you can do that. But if you wanted to run an ad that said, we don't like current laws, we would like to change current laws, that was censored. You couldn't do that. Now, it's hard to imagine, in some ways, an easier case to win that on First Amendment grounds, and the courts, you know, did the right thing there. But the fact that Congress would even do that is just astounding. Congress also passed a law saying that when the District of Columbia ran a medical marijuana ballot initiative, that the votes couldn't be counted. Again, unimaginable. How could you? I mean, what a blatant assault to such a fundamental thing. The only example I can think of in recent history is that a dictator in Nigeria, when it looked like he was going to lose the rigged election, seized the ballot boxes and didn't let the votes be counted. But that's something that the majority of the members of Congress felt would be okay. And again, the courts, you know, thankfully were able to intervene and come out with the right solution there. And then finally, the area of privacy. And the Fourth Amendment is really the main protection in the area of privacy. I think this is probably most familiar to people who are involved in drug policy, the sort of way that police have expanded, ever-expanding powers, and privacy is ever-shrinking. But it really is, I think, important to realize the scope of that. A case called Wren, for instance, established what I think is a completely radical proposition, which is that when police officers stop you for a traffic violation, they don't need to actually care about the traffic violation, the broken taillight. It's perfectly fine for them to be stopping you for no other reason but to be able to get near you, to look into your car, to see if their drugs are there, to bring a drug-sniffing dog in a separate case. That's not considered a search. So basically, the erosion of your fundamental right to be left alone. And so what I want to conclude with is just where that right comes from. When the founders of this country wrote the Fourth Amendment, they were concerned about the idea that British troops were going door to door, house to house, to see if you had contraband in your house. Right, and that day the contraband was rum, tobacco, and molasses, and tea, to see if you pay taxes on it. But they didn't need to suspect that you had done anything wrong. They could simply insist on coming into your house to see if maybe you had done something wrong. And the Fourth Amendment is supposed to be the opposite of that, that as long as you don't appear to be doing anything wrong, you get left alone. And in case after case after case, from drug testing to car searches to drug dogs, just across the board, the war on drugs has been the engine of taking away that presumption. So that increasingly, even if there's no reason to think you've done something wrong, the police have all of these different ways of finding out if maybe there's some evidence that you have. And the implications, of course, go way beyond drugs. So free speech, religion, privacy, and the list goes on. If you go through the Bill of Rights, most of the worst decisions, most of those decisions that have contracted the fundamental notion of who we are as a democratic people, were justified by this sense of urgency that we're fighting a war against drugs. And in wartime, we have to make exceptions. So as we imagine alternative regimes, things that are a little bit better, sentences that are a little bit lower, protections that are a little bit more. Let's also think about, are we still leaving in place a paradigm in which over time we can see our Constitution, our democracy, piece by piece crumble, fall apart, until what we're left with is a very strong authoritative government and a very eroded sense of our own personal rights. Thanks very much.
Once again, you are listening to Century of Lies on the Drug Truth Network, and that was Graham Boyd of the American Civil Liberties Union. Graham spoke at the Exit Strategy for the War on Drugs conference held in Seattle, Washington, sponsored by the King County Bar Association, kcba.org. I don't have any travel in mind for the next couple of months. It'll give us an opportunity to bring you several more programs, which I was able to record at this Exit Strategy conference. Okay, now to some quick news. The new year has started off properly. The Rhode Island legislature overwhelmingly overrode their governor's veto of a bill to protect medical marijuana patients from arrest. As a result, Rhode Island is now the 11th state where medical marijuana use, possession, and cultivation is legal. And it's the first state to enact a medical marijuana law since the U.S. Supreme Court's decision in Gonzales versus Raich. Significantly, Rhode Island's new law is the first state medical marijuana law to be enacted over the veto of a governor. I think those legislators are saying something to our drug czar, John Walters, something like, in your face. And another slap in the drug czar's face occurred later the same week when the FDA approved phase 3 trial studies for Sativex. This is a new product, an under-the-tongue spray made by GW Pharmaceuticals that's going to be dispensed to Americans in America who are suffering from pain associated with cancer. According to Reuters, quote, the U.S. randomized clinical trial will involve 250 people and is likely to last between 24 and 36 months, suggesting Sativex will not be ready for launch in the U.S. marketplace until towards the end of the decade. Jeffrey Guy, GW's executive chairman, said the acceptance of the Phase 3 study application by the Food and Drug Administration was a significant achievement for the company that would compress the overall length of time needed to win U.S. approval. Cannabis has a long history of medicinal use, dating back to ancient Chinese times. Queen Victoria, whose physician described it as, quote, one of the most valuable medicines we possess, end quote, is said to have taken cannabis tincture for her menstrual pains, end of Reuters quote. And for those of you who may not know, Sativex is made of pure marijuana. They extract the THC, they extract the cannabinoids, and they make a 50-50 mixture. And now, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has approved its use here in the United States. That silly drug czar John Walters tours the nation saying there are no medical associations that support marijuana. Yet in Rhode Island, those who did support it included the Rhode Island Medical Society, the Rhode Island Nurses Association, and AIDS Project Rhode Island. Please be sure to join us on this week's Cultural Baggage Show when our guest will be Bruce Merkin, the Director of Communications for the Marijuana Policy Project. Their website, mpp.org. We're going to kick this around pretty good. There is no truth, justice, logic, scientific fact, medical data. In fact, there is no reason for this drug war to continue. We have been duped. Please do your part to help end this madness. Visit our website, nprohibition.org. Prohibido esta aquí valesco. For the Drug Truth Network, this is Dean Becker asking you to examine our policy of drug prohibition, the Century of Lies. The show produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston. Our engineer, Philip Duffy.